From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The pros and cons of the move in Frederick County to repeal its three-year-old English-only ordinance. Some contend it sends the wrong message to immigrants. Defenders argue it helps keep Frederick from becoming a sanctuary for the undocumented. Then, in the 90s, sociologist Patricia Fernandez-Kelly was studying the effects of the disappearance of industrial jobs. She immersed herself in the lives of several families in West Baltimore and tells us what she learned. Plus, theater critic J. Wen Russick reviews the latest from the Baltimore Playwrights Festival about a divorced middle-aged mother who joins a support group called Single Women Actively Seeking Sex. And local novelist and poet Madeline Misko gives us a beach read that unfolds in a beach community in New Jersey, Stone Harbor Bound. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The state of Maryland does not have an official language, but three of its counties do. First was Frederick County. In 2012, its commissioners adopted an ordinance requiring, quote, all official actions in the county must be in English, close quote. Now, Frederick is again debating the issue quite vigorously. During the intervening 3 years, Frederick County has changed its form of government. Instead of a 5-member board of commissioners, who were all Republican, it now has a 7-member county council of 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats. 2 of the Democrats have proposed repealing the English-only ordinance. One of them, Jessica Fitzwater, is with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Glad to be here.
And joining us by phone is Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, a Republican who is advocating for keeping the ordinance in place. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Jessica Fitzwater, let's begin by clarifying what the statement, all official actions in the county must be in English, what that means.
Well, before the ordinance was in place, the official actions of the Frederick County government were already taking place in English. That had been the case for all time that we have been able to find any records. Previously to this ordinance, there was a resolution in place that was put forth in 2008 that stated that the official language of the county government would be English. So there is a difference between saying that the county government will do its official actions in English, and the 2012 ordinance says that it's the official language of the county. So there has been some debate as to what that, how you can interpret those two things and what that may change.
So why do you feel that the ordinance is harmful to Frederick County?
When you look at the actual language within the ordinance, it actually doesn't have any teeth. There's a whole list of exceptions because there are many state and federal language access laws and laws that protect the rights of people with limited English proficiency. And Frederick County has been abiding by those laws, again, regardless of this ordinance being in place. So it really is superseded by state and federal law. When this ordinance was debated and adopted in 2012 and since, we have received a lot of negative attention in the media. And we also have heard from many of our business leaders that it's tarnished our reputation as a hospitable community. That affects our ability to recruit and retain the best businesses in Frederick. We have a lot of biotech and life science firms in Frederick that are recruiting scientists and researchers from all over the world. Wherever the best are, that's where we want them to come to Frederick. And when you have something like this on the books that isn't really doing anything of substance but is having a big impact on our perception, it's difficult to move forward.
Sheriff Jenkins, you oppose repeal of the ordinance. Why do you think designating English as the official language is important?
Well, I do. Basically on the fundamental premise that, you know, the United States is about one language. We are one culture. And I think demonstrating at a local level and making the statement that English is the official language, I think is important. You know, as Jessica said, it really never changed the way we do business. I just think it's very important, and I think when you go down this road, okay, when you go down this road to say making statements like this, try to repeal these things, I think it starts to lend itself to cities like Frederick, counties like Frederick becoming what we call now sanctuary counties. And this is not about illegal immigration, but what this is about English being the way we do business in Frederick County. And if I remember correctly, the whole premise for this back in 2008 when it started was to basically try to avoid the expected cost of up to $250,000, I think it was, in the production of documents and cost to provide all these official documents and other and printings in other languages. So I think it's really important we maintain the ordinance the way it is. I think it makes a strong statement. And honestly, 87% of Americans right now want English to be the official language. So I'm opposed to this.
I want to make sure I'm following. You said this is not about illegal immigration, but you...
It's not. And a lot of people are trying to make that fight here locally right now. Some of the people who support Ms. Fitzwater's proposal have made this about illegal immigration, and it's simply not. It's about the county doing business and the county doing what they can to offset the cost of printing and producing materials in other languages. That's how this whole thing started back in 2008.
But you made a reference to your concern that repeal could move Frederick toward becoming a sanctuary county.
This, in my opinion, when you look at the broad issue of across the country, when a local jurisdiction takes steps like this, it starts to go down the road to look at Frederick County as potentially a sanctuary county. One of the points Ms. Fitzwater made about businesses expressing concerns, I've been sheriff for almost 9 years. I'm out in this public. I deal with businesses. I've never heard that as a concern.
Jessica?
The other thing I want to point out is a part of her first paragraph in the ordinance or the repeal is that ensuring that non-English-speaking or non-English-language speakers are not deterred from reporting crimes. Okay, it doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. There's nothing to demonstrate that this deters people from reporting crimes or being protected as crime victims.
I want to give Councilwoman Fitzwater a chance to respond, but let me just say first, this is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with County Sheriff Chuck Jenkins and Frederick County Councilwoman Jessica Fitzwater about a proposal to repeal Frederick County's ordinance making English the official language. Councilwoman Fitzwater.
I would just like to respond to a couple of things. I'll first respond to the assertion that there's costs that the ordinance was adopted for cost-saving reasons. That's been an argument that we've heard often. We went back through the records. There's no record of a fiscal analysis or a fiscal impact statement being done on the original ordinance showing that there would be any cost savings. And looking through subsequent budget years, there's no evidence that there's been any cost savings. Many of the translations and interpretation services that the county does are required by law. And those
required by federal?
By state, by state law and by federal law. We have the Civil Rights Act. We have executive order that was passed, I believe, in 2000. And they require access to any agency that's receiving federal funds to make sure that those programs and services are accessible to people with limited English proficiency. So there's many cases where we are required to provide these services, and we have been. So, of course, there are costs associated to that, but none of that has changed with or without an ordinance such as this. Secondly, the sheriff mentioned he is actually the one that brought up illegal immigration, and he said that people who are in support of repeal have made that part of the debate. And I would just have to disagree. It really became part of the debate with people who are opposed to the repeal. We have many, many legal citizens and residents of Frederick County who don't speak English as their primary language or as their first language. They pay taxes just like I do, and they have every right to have access to all the government services that I do, and to make sure that Frederick County is seen as an open-minded and a welcoming place to everybody, no matter what your first language is.
Sheriff Jenkins, I want to make sure that we're clear about immigration, illegal immigration. Do you see this language ordinance as a separate issue from policies concerning immigration?
I do. Yes, I do. One of the things I want to point out, again, it's not all about that, but it's been part of the conversation.
I would also like to mention that in 2012, when this was adopted, there's an organization called Pro English that's a national organization. They came into the debate in 2012, and they actually provided the Board of County Commissioners at the time with the model language for this ordinance. Much of the ordinance language was written by Pro English. There's statements in the ordinance such as, in today's society, Frederick County may need to protect the rights of those who only speak the English language. And to me, I interpret that as fear language, that somehow English is under attack. And we found pro-English becoming involved again back in the debate when the bill was introduced to repeal. They did robocalls, emails, letters to mailboxes, radio ads, saying things like the English language is under attack. And we got phone calls from people who now thought Spanish was going to be the official language, or that everything was going to have to be in English and Spanish. And just a lot of misinformation. And it's you know, it's concerning when an outside group like that comes in and spins the debate. And pro-English is labeled by some organizations such as the Southern Poverty Law Center as an active anti-immigrant hate group. So immigration does play into the conversation.
I don't want to make Sheriff Jenkins responsible for pro-English unless, Sheriff, you'd like to address any of that.
No, she's right. And listen, I'm also opposed to outside groups coming in and trying to influence county policy and ordinances. So, Jessica, I agree with you on that point. I think this is all about the people of Frederick County. And you talked about Frederick County being a diverse and welcoming community. I've been here 60 years of my life, and we are very welcoming. I don't think there's ever been an attempt, nor has there ever been demonstrated that we're not. I frankly don't see what this is all about. I think, again, I think this is looking for a problem that doesn't exist.
Let me just ask you, Councilman Fitzwater, this ordinance was adopted just 3 years ago. Do you think sentiment in the county has changed?
Well, even if you look back at when the ordinance was adopted and then since, how the county is portrayed in the state, in local state, even national media, we did get a reputation for this. And the sheriff already said that it doesn't really do a lot, but it makes a statement. We disagree on whether that statement is what Frederick County should be about.
Sheriff Jenkins?
Yes. Okay. I guess I've made the points I want to make here. And again, I just believe that the county as a whole, when you look at the local government level, that we function very well with the current ordinance. I mean, I think it's less divisive. I think we function better as a whole. And I just think to go down this road to repeal this, again, I think it's going to give the appearance that we are now heading toward becoming a sanctuary county, and that concerns me.
Well, I appreciate you're both giving us some insight into what the debate is about. As I understand it, the County Council is to vote on this issue on Tuesday, August 18th. So thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica Fitzwater is a Frederick County Councilwoman, sponsor of the bill to repeal the ordinance requiring official actions in English. Chuck Jenkins, who supports the existing ordinance, is sheriff of Frederick County. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. More ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In the 1990s, sociologist Patricia Fernandez-Kelly was a research scientist at the Johns Hopkins Institute for Policy Studies. When her research into what effects deindustrialization was having on city residents took her into West Baltimore, she immersed herself in the lives of several families, working to understand their experience and, in particular, the relation between them and government. The result is the book Fernandez Kelly published this spring, The Heroes Fight, African Americans in West Baltimore and the Shadow of the State. Patricia Fernandez Kelly joins us on the line from Princeton University, where she's now a senior lecturer in sociology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You paint a picture of a very warped relationship between government agencies, local, state, and federal, and poor people. You basically say government workers view the poor, who in the city are overwhelmingly black, as burdens, not people.
I would not want to cast any aspersions on a very dedicated, overworked, and underpaid public officials who interact with impoverished individuals and families. It is the institutions that I focus on in this book. These institutions, I call them liminal institutions because they stand in this kind of twilight zone in which procedures and guidelines make it possible for people to not be treated as citizens or consumers, but rather as potential burdens on the society. So in fact, social workers, teachers, police officers, all kinds of public servants on a daily basis have to try very hard in order to treat people as human beings, because the actual procedures embedded in those institutions make it very difficult for them, and certainly very difficult for impoverished individuals and families who tend to be constantly addressed as if they were potentially felons. So the emphasis of these institutions is mostly on containment, on punishment. The poor in this country, and I'm not the first one to say this, are treated very differently from the way you and I are treated. We are treated as consumers, as citizens. We are not required in most cases to demonstrate our deservedness in order to receive some of the benefits that we feel we are entitled from the society as represented by the state.
One of the people you introduce us to from West Baltimore is a man you call Big Floyd. Fairly young, he has several children early with his very young girlfriend, and you describe his, quote, blundering attempts at independence, close quote. Tell us about Big Floyd.
So Big Floyd is a very important personage because he reflects the experience of many impoverished men. He grew up in Baltimore at a time in which the city had gone from being a significant industrial center to an area completely depleted from resources. In the early 70s, Bethlehem Steel was the largest employer of people in the city. By the time Big Floyd was born, Bethlehem Steel was only hiring fewer than 8,000 people from the many thousands, close to 30,000 that it had employed in previous decades. And as a result, he was, like many other impoverished black men in the city, he faced great difficulty in attempts at finding jobs. In addition, he was attending schools that are underfunded and not able to provide adequate education. As with many other people who are poor, he turned to the idea of family and had three children with his young girlfriend, who herself faced tremendous burdens. What was so impressive about Big Floyd is that he kept on trying to be a father. And although his children had been taken away by Child Protective Services and allocated to different members of family and foster care, his dream was to get them together, and he kept on trying to find a job. And eventually he did find a job as a security guard. And lo and behold, when he entered a police station in order to get clearance, knowing that he had a clear and unburdened record, he didn't smoke, he didn't do drugs, he had not been in trouble with the law. But right there, he was arrested and taken to jail because he had failed to make a court appearance on behalf of one of his children concerning child support. this is a very good illustration of a problem that I discuss in the book, and that is the excessively punitive measures towards men who are very vulnerable and who are in their own way trying to put together the funds to support their children, but who are penalized heavily when they do not succeed.
Do you especially object to using police and courts and jails to enforce child support?
I don't think that using the police in order to enforce child support payments is the best of ideas. Community-founded strategies in experimental situations have been much more effective. But the presumption is that somehow all fathers are trying to escape fatherly responsibilities, and that's not what I saw in West Baltimore. What I saw in West Baltimore was a lot of men who would have loved to have the resources to pay child support payments and who could not find the jobs or the means in order to fulfill those dreams.
That's Patricia Fernandez-Kelly, senior lecturer in sociology at Princeton University, here on Maryland Morning, WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her book, The Hero's Fight, African Americans in West Baltimore and the Shadow of the State. I don't think there's any agency in the book that comes in for as sharp criticism from you as Child Protective Services. You say it tends to undercut what meager authority parents in the inner city have over their children. Explain that.
This is a problem that most of us would prefer not to even face, because it is true that children experience tremendous levels of abuse and cruelty at the hands of adults, whether parents or strangers. And I think that we all agree that children must be protected. The question is whether the institutions, as they currently exist under the name of Child Protective Services, are fulfilling that mandate in any effective way. And my sense from a communication with the families, and remember, I knew these families, 50 families, 165 different individuals with whom I interacted deeply. And what I saw while doing my research is that most of the people that were disciplined by Child Protective Services had committed comparatively small transgressions. They had slapped their children around, they had spanked them, they had thrown them against the wall when they were not obedient. And as a result, they had to face public officials, go to court, and then their names were included in rosters of alleged child abusers for long periods of time. This was information that the children themselves, especially in their teenage years, took seriously because, and this is another thing that we don't do very well, we do not understand that children are social agents and that they will use the information and the resources available to them in order to negotiate and gain some power vis-a-vis parents. So most children do not lie about child abuse. That is true. But some children do, and the children most likely to use Child Protective Services in order to get power over their parents are children in their teenage years who know that their parents will be investigated and that their power over them, as little as it is, will be checked. So here I'm not demonizing children. I'm saying children are using information and resources in order to do what children do. Middle-class children use other resources in the same way, and that is to gain a bit of autonomy, a little bit of power and negotiation capacity vis-a-vis their parents. I also notice that such institutions are not terribly effective in curtailing truly egregious forms of abuse. So my push is not for the elimination of protective strategies, but for rethinking how we try to implement policies. The presumption that parents are abusing their children in adversarial ways could be rethought, and we could have, again, community-based and better informed practices that would allow parents to participate in better parenting strategies. These practices, as they exist today, have a disproportionate effect upon impoverished people. The vast majority of names included in rosters of child abusers at the national level are African Americans and Latinos of very, very meager means. And so we have an effect of class, we have an effect of race. We can do much better.
Have you stayed in touch with the families that you got to know in the 90s in West Baltimore?
Not all of them, but several of them, about 20 different individuals. Let me also add that several of the people who I met as babies or very young individuals in the 1990s are now dead. And they're either dead as a result of the pressures of diabetes and other related issues. Right now I can count at least five of the young people who I met and had a deep interaction with who have died violent deaths, one of them only last summer.
And they're facing, the next generation is facing the same problems that you saw in the
90s? Yes, I can guarantee that the very same cycle of despair and difficulty, the same barriers, will continue to exist unless we decide to do something. And these are the major issues. Residential segregation, when you have areas like West Baltimore, where poverty rates are very high, unemployment rates are very high, and where everybody is black and interacting constantly with liminal institutions that treat them as if they were burdens on the society, very little will be changed. And so, yes, sadly, I expect that the same cycle will be reproduced in the future because we continue to take a piecemeal approach. We are trying to teach the poor to dress for success or to behave better. But we do not do anything about context. We don't know anything about the spaces in which there are no resources, which spaces that are very vulnerable to the drug trade, spaces that are populated by public officials who are underpaid and poorly trained and who react violently towards the violence of young people involved in drug trade and other mischief, etc. So we may actually spend millions of dollars trying to fix the behavior of poor people, but until we fix the spaces in which people live, there will be very little change.
Thank you for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Patricia Fernandez-Kelly is senior lecturer in sociology at Princeton University. Her new book is The Hero's Fight, African Americans in West Baltimore and the Shadow of the State. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. 3 weeks ago, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviewed Commander, the first play in this year's Baltimore Playwrights Festival. This morning, she tells us about the second offering in the festival, a new play called Saving Myself for Steve Martin.
Single women actively seeking sex. Those words appear on a sign on stage at the Strand Theater's production of Saving Myself for Steve Martin. SWAS, the awkward acronym on the sign, is a support group. Over the next 80 minutes or so, we hear from the group's newest member. Eve is a 45-year-old, just-divorced mother of an adolescent daughter. Anne V. Wixon, author of Saving Myself for Steve Martin, structures this Baltimore Playwrights Festival selection as a series of monthly group meetings from September through May. It's a structure that's rather formulaic and at times repetitive. At each meeting, Eve, the sole character in the play, gives a report on her progress, or regress, in her quest for hookups. She has frequent furious rants against the husband who dumped her, but she has sweet reminiscences of her first husband, who died 2 years after they were married. These suggest that this single woman might be seeking more than just sex. Karen Rosniczak plays Eve as enthusiastic, verging on hyper, and with a strong, self-deprecating sense of humor. At the first meeting, Eve admits she's been out of the dating pool so long, she doesn't know how to get back in.
How do I even get to the naked stage? I don't even know where to meet men, let alone strip naked for them. What are the rules? Have they changed? How do I dress? If it's okay for Paris Hilton to wear a belt as a skirt, can I? Who pays for what? What do I talk about? Where do you even go on a first date?
If anyone in the support group has any advice, we don't find out. Eve and the script barely acknowledge the group's presence. Forging boldly ahead on her own, Eve goes on a blind date with a guy who turns out to be more like Prince Alarming than Prince Charming.
I had planned on dazzling him with witty conversation on the right of the restaurant, but I never got the chance. He told me I wasn't as ugly as he had imagined, but that a few years certainly do make a difference in the waistline, don't they?
Her date's criticism of her appearance brings up a casting and costume problem. Director Miriam Bazansky has found a very warm, sympathetic, and attractive actress in Karen Rosniczak. No matter how much Eve complains about her looks or rails against 20-year-olds running around in their low-rise jeans, Rosniczak looks fabulous in her low-rise jeans. At the very least, she needs a frumpier costume. In another respect, the production looks just fine. Saving Myself for Steve Martin is being performed at Church & Company, a former church in Hamden. With the audience seated on an array of mismatched chairs, the venue feels like the setting for a support group. There are several passages that showcase playwright Wixon's writing skill. Eve's account of Christmas with her first husband is endearing, and a romantic scene gone wrong near the end of the play is genuinely funny. The title, by the way, shows up at the group's March meeting. Fed up with her dating experiences, Eve decides she'll wait for someone intelligent, funny, cultured, attractive, and so far out of my reach I will never meet him. That is, Steve Martin. The idea and the title feel a bit forced. Saving Myself for Steve Martin isn't the only one-woman show about a single mother returning to the dating world. A few seasons back, Olney Theatre Center staged Bad Dates by Teresa Rebick, best known for the TV series Smash. Rebick, however, incorporated a full-fledged plot into her play. But the Baltimore Playwrights Festival isn't just a showcase for polished work. It's also a forum to identify talent. At this point, Saving Myself for Steve Martin may be more a collection of stories, closer to journal entries, than a fully realized play. But the script contains some sharp writing and character development, and that's a promising start.
I'm too sexy for my love, too sexy for my love, love's going to leave me.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Saving Myself for Steve Martin is part of the Baltimore Theater Festival. It's at the Strand Theater until Sunday. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Coming up after a break, a conversation with the Baltimore author Madeline Misko. She's got a new novel. Stay with us.
And I am too sexy for Milan, too sexy for Milan, New York and Japan. And I am too sexy for your party, too sexy for your party. The way I'm disco dancing, I'm a model, you know what I mean. And I do my little turn on the catwalk, yeah, on the catwalk, on the catwalk, yeah. I do my little turn on the catwalk.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-4242. 3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Local author Madeline Misko joins me in the studio. She has recently published her second novel. So in this season for Beach Reads, here's a novel that takes place in a beach community. It's called Stone Harbor on the New Jersey Shore, and the book is called Stone Harbor Bound. Welcome back to the show, Madeline Misko.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. So your first novel, Bringing Vincent Home, which we talked about on this show a few years ago, had a nurse in it. She was an Army nurse in Vietnam. You yourself are a nurse, and your protagonist in this book, Stone Harbor Bound, is also a nurse. So tell us a little bit about Camille.
Camille is a nurse with a different problem. She has had a long-time relationship with a woman who has recently died. That woman is named Bridget Gallagher. And Bridget Gallagher loves the town of Stone Harbor, New Jersey, and actually owns a little bungalow there. And along with a lot of other problems, Bridget has died and left the bungalow to Camille. And Camille needs to make up her mind what to do about it. So that's where we begin the story.
So Camille herself didn't have the attachment to this bungalow, you know, that Bridget did. But here she did. She's sort of stuck with it in a way. But it's not that she's not fond of it. She went there a lot of times with Bridget, right?
Yes. Camille loves Bridget, still loves her after her death. But I don't think she ever really loved the town of Stone Harbor, because Stone Harbor belonged to Bridget long before Camille did. And there's that little jealousy thing about Bridget being so attached to her family, but the family not particularly attached to Camille. So there's that sort of outsider feel, I think, for Camille.
Yeah, and I bet that's a dynamic a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah.
Why don't you read us just a little clip from, this is from the top of the book, the beginning of the book, where Camille is coming into Stone Harbor for the first time in this particular summer.
Okay, I'd be glad to. By the time Camille drove over the Stone Harbor Bridge, the sun had come out. Up ahead, in the haze, the low buildings of the town seemed dipped in silver. "We have arrived." Like a burst of startled laughter came the memory of Bridget whooping and yelling out the car window, as she did every time they arrived at the bridge. Bridget, large and alive, her wild hair blowing across her freckled face. "We have arrived." There was a story to it, of course. How Bridget, her sisters, and her little brother Daniel would wait for the exact moment when the old paneled station wagon got to the bridge, at which point their father would boom, "We have arrived, Gallagher children," and they'd all yell back, "We have arrived."
These traditions that families have, these summer places that families go to, as I say, is a dynamic that a lot of people can relate to. I find with music, for example, people associate certain songs and certain music with certain events and certain places. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a lot of associations of this place with your character, Camille, and we go back and forth between the time in this summer in Stone Harbor and prior to that time when Bridget and Camille, you know, get to know each other. What is your connection to Stone Harbor, New Jersey?
Well, interestingly, my connection is similar. It's an outsider connection in that I had never been to Stone Harbor before the year I got married in 2001. I went there with my husband. His family has been going to Stone Harbor since he was 10 years old, many years. And so I was, unlike Camille, instantly loved Stone Harbor, but I was learning these family traditions. So every summer we'd go there, and I would just walk the town and take notes. And I wrote a number of short stories that take place in Stone Harbor, and that eventually became a novel.
Yeah, and is, you know, when you're in a place where your husband knows sort of every rock and every, you know, tree and every sand on every piece of sand on the beach, did it take you a while? Was it a matter of years before you sort of, you know, felt it was your own?
I think I felt it was my own when I finished the novel.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, that's my next question. Did the novel help you sort of, you know, really incorporate it as something that is your own?
I sort of made it my own. I think I did just by, you know, and really, we're only there for a little while each summer, but it took me 7 years to write the novel. So, I mean, I was just collecting material over that time.
And you bring up a number of, you know, big issues. You talk about alcoholism in this mm-hmm. book. You talk a lot about religion in this book. You talk about bigotry, anti-gay bigotry in particular. What do you think makes fiction, either a novel or a short story, the best place, the best space to take up those kinds of, you know, large notions?
Well, I think fiction has allowed me to explore things that ordinarily are hard to talk about. Alcoholism, for example. I mean, I dealt with alcoholism in my first novel. And it's something that's very, very hard if you have any history with it in your own family or among your friends to deal with straight out. And my first novel was going to be nonfiction. It was going to be a memoir of my time in the Army. But then I realized I could do so much more with fiction. And I think I went straight to fiction with this story.
Mm-hmm. You're also a poet. I first mm-hmm. knew your work as a poet. Now we've got a couple of novels, as you say, 7 years in between the first and the second novel. Are you still writing poetry as well?
I am. I'm in a very strong poetry group here that formed 20 years ago. There are four of us, and we get together regularly to support each other, and I continue to write poetry.
Yeah. Can you turn that light on and off when you're writing fiction as well?
Sometimes I am not sure what I'm writing. I don't know whether I'm going to be writing. I also write some nonfiction now, some creative nonfiction. So it's like, is this poetry or is this fiction? And sometimes the problem is figuring out which thing that I'm working on a particular idea belongs in.
Yeah. We talked about the fact that the book goes back and forth between the sort of present time in Stone Harbor in the summer and the times that Bridget and Camille spent together as Camille got to know Bridget's family, et cetera. Was it difficult? Was that structure difficult to bounce back from time to time and place to place? Did you find that a challenge?
It was a challenge. Actually, I had four or five short stories that I was trying to turn into a novel. And I came up with Camille as the character who was not in any of those stories but would be the connecting person. And the novel was rejected a couple of times because there were too many storylines running and I had to cut some storylines. But once I had Camille and I had that relationship with Bridget, it all began to fall into place. But it was hard, the back and forth.
Madeline Misko, her second novel is called Stone Harbor Bound. She'll be joined by her friend Jean Oishi for a reading at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore tomorrow night. Jean's new book is called Fox Drum Bebop. It's about generations of Japanese Americans following a family's internment during the Second World War. I spoke to Jean about that book a while back, and you can hear that conversation along with this conversation with Madeline Misko at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Well, Madeline, congratulations on the book and good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
That's it for us today. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Jonna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1892, the Charles County Courthouse in Port Tobacco burned to the ground. Arson was suspected. Port Tobacco had been Charles County seat for 150 years, but after the fire, citizens voted to move it to La Plata, where a new courthouse was built in 1895. We're back on Wednesday. Hope you will be, too.